This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio, and we also stream on the web at kzyx.org. It's 7 o'clock. Good evening. We're getting ready for Education Now. Education Now... support for Education Now comes from our members and the Knitted Brow and the Caretaker's Garden, both in Boonville. The Healthy Home Series begins November 1st. Angela DeWitt and Wendy Reed host 6 Sunday afternoon classes, Spinning with a Drop Spindle on November 1st and Identification of Medicinal Herbs on November 8th. Registration at 895-9074. Once again, 895-9074. The Knitted Brow sounds so wonderful. And the Hermeneutic Institution and support for Education Now comes from our members and the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation offering educational consulting and in-person or online tutoring. Information at pacificsites.com/TildaHermes. Well, thank you for joining us. And now let's have some music. Here we go.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked.
Well, welcome, welcome, welcome to Education Now. I have a treat for you tonight, very important, from Save the Children, Mary Beth, and we're going to go right into that interview now, so have a listen. Here we go. Well, it's a beautiful afternoon here in Philo, California, and on the line with me is Mary Beth, Survive to Five campaign chief for Save the Children. Save the Children is the leading independent organization that creates lasting change for children in need in the United States and around the world. Save the Children USA is a member of the International Save the Children Alliance, a global network of 27 independent Save the Children organizations working to ensure the well-being and protection of children in more than 120 countries. And Mary Beth is here to tell us about a new program that can save the lives of nearly 2 million children under 5 globally. Welcome to our airwaves, Mary Beth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, so tell us about this program.
Well, Save the Children has been on the forefront of strengthening the delivery of health services for children in developing countries and really looking at some of the main causes of death for children. You know, when we ask Americans what they think children die of around the world, of course, a lot of people talk about diseases like AIDS and malaria, which do affect children's health. But actually, the biggest killers of children around the world are pneumonia and diarrhea, two things that we rarely lose children to in this country. So our program, Survive to Five, is really focusing on those things and those interventions which, if we could provide them to children in developing countries, could easily save their lives at very low cost.
Yes, and this the strategy is using... zinc used in combination with sugar, salt, and water?
Right. We've been working on, for probably 30 years, the public health community has been promoting this sugar and salt solution to treat children with diarrhea. So it would be like how maybe a person in the United States would feed their child Pedialyte if a young child was sick with diarrhea. So something very similar exists globally, and we teach moms all around the world how to mix this sugar salt solution to treat kids with diarrhea. But we did some groundbreaking work with Johns Hopkins in Mali in West Africa, adding zinc tablets to the treatment. So the oral rehydration solution, the sugar salt solution, mixed with boiled water, plus this addition of zinc tablets, which a child takes for twice a day for 7 days, actually costs about $1 all in, and it can save a child from diarrhea. And the fascinating thing about zinc is that we found it lessens both the severity of the illness and also the length of the illness, and the child is less likely to get sick with diarrhea for the rest of the rainy season, for example. So it's a real breakthrough, and it's a simple thing, and, you know, it's available in our diets and vegetables sometimes, but a lot of these kids don't have enough zinc in their diet, so we have to give them these supplements.
Yes, and according to the literature, a national demographic survey estimates that close to 90,000 babies and toddlers die from this treatable illness.
Yes, in Mali, it's about 250 kids a day who are dying from diarrhea, so just one country. Around the world, it's even more. It's about 5,000 children every day dying from diarrhea. So this is something that, you know, it can be prevented, of course, getting families to use cleaner water, et cetera. But the most important thing is we're not going to prevent all diarrhea, so it's critical that kids and parents and health workers in communities know how to treat diarrhea properly.
Yes, and now they do, and we could save so many lives. Is it properly funded?
Well, yeah, the trouble with zinc right now is that the supplier is really just one company right now that's largely providing the zinc tablets used by many countries around the world to treat diarrhea. So we do need funding for these programs to add zinc to the regular treatment of diarrhea. So until governments adopt this zinc formulation and add it to the treatment of diarrhea all the time and, you know, start importing it, there's actually a shortage of funding for this very simple treatment that can save a child's life. So I think organizations like Save the Children could use more support for our work in diarrhea management.
And are you getting a good reception from the public? I mean, when did the campaign start?
Well, we've been working on the Survive to Five campaign, which is really looking holistically at some of the main killers of children, as I said, not just diarrhea, but pneumonia, which actually kills even more children than diarrhea, and then newborn complications, so problems that happen during pregnancy, birth, and in the first few hours and days of life. Those have really been the focus of our campaign. And we've done a number of things. We've educated Americans. We ran a knitting campaign last year. It was called Knit One, Save One, where we asked Americans to crochet or knit a newborn baby cap, and also to write a letter to the president-elect. So we ran it last fall. Didn't matter who was the president, but we're really looking for Americans to let Congress and the administration know that we should make this a priority, saving mothers and children globally. It's something we actually know how to do, and it's something, it's, you know, really the best expenditure we could make of our foreign assistance dollars around the world. And we got a lot of people knitting and crocheting all across America. All 50 states participated. A lot of people wrote letters to President Obama asking him to make maternal and child health, you know, really a global leadership position for the United States. And we also got a lot of people making small contributions that can make a difference. For example, $10 for something we call a newborn baby kit. So it's something, the cap itself, plus a bar of soap and some helpful information to moms, coaching to moms through mother-to-mother communication or community health workers, talking to moms about the behaviors that can help save a newborn baby's life.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. And in terms of other countries, it's not just Mali, Bangladesh, India, Pakistan.
Right, Afghanistan, Nepal, Uganda, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Nigeria. I mean, when you look at actually in just 10 countries, about 60% of these children die. So those include places like India, Bangladesh, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Afghanistan, Pakistan. I mean, high population countries with a relatively poor population who don't have easy access to health information and health services. So I know we have healthcare shortages and challenges in this country, but I just came back Tuesday from Bangladesh, and the healthcare situation and the nutrition situation for children there is still alarming. So we really need to make it possible to bring healthcare beyond clinic walls. We're never going to do this if we try and wait till we can build clinics in every village around the world. We have to train people in the community to know these simple solutions like the oral rehydration solution and zinc, or like how to diagnose a child at the community level who has pneumonia and to treat that child with antibiotics. So something, again, deaths from pneumonia are largely preventable, but often parents don't realize how sick the child is until it's too late, and then the child needs to go to the hospital, whereas earlier in the disease, they could have been treated right in the community.
Yes, yes, I hear you. I know also that, what are the consequences now? You know, even if someone survives this, I mean, there's a lot of consequences to that child's rest of its life, right?
Yes, and that's a great point, Athena, because actually children who are battling these diseases, like the longer the disease lags on, say, you know, the long diarrhea because it was treated but maybe not treated with the addition of zinc, that leads to nutritional deficiencies in the child, and those have lifelong consequences for that child's learning ability. So malnutrition generally, but disease as well, contributes to children being malnourished, using up their energy, trying to fight off infection instead of growing, and that leads to kids who are not, don't perform as well in school, who often have anemia or other deficiencies that cause them to, you know, lifelong learning challenges.
Yes, lifelong learning challenges that could be prevented if there was just everybody cared just enough. I mean, when I think of all the money that's wasted on death, and here we could do something for life, and I just hope that Save the Children has so much success. I know that you were featured in Time, right? And a Time article on the web at time.com, and an article. When did was the article in the August 7th edition?
Yes, it was in the August 7th international edition of Time magazine. And that has led to a lot of interest in this diarrhea case management, and the fact that, you know, literally for a dollar you can help us save a child's life. So it is an important new intervention. Like I said, the oral rehydration solutions we've known about for 30 years. They were tested in the 70s in places like Bangladesh and Egypt. So those are really important. But I know it's hard for people to relate to, because our children, you know, thank God, are spared some of these diseases, or we have easy access to medical care for our kids. But in fact, for families around the world who live very, very far from clinics and perhaps don't have the cash needed to visit the clinic, or have another reason that they can't get the child to clinic, they fare much worse.
Yes, they do. Thank you for that. Are there any other projects that are going on now with Save the Children that you'd like our listeners to know about?
Well, I think that the other main killer of children is pneumonia. So we have been doing a lot of work around the world training community health workers very simply to diagnose with basically symptomatic diagnosis of pneumonia. So they have a protocol. They're certified to do this kind of diagnosis and treatment. They go through a training course and they practice. Often we take them to a hospital to practice diagnosing children who has pneumonia, who doesn't. And it's a simple kind of test, how many respiration rates or how many times the child breathes in 30 seconds, and then whether the child experiences chest indrawing, et cetera. And so they have these symptoms along with fever that they're looking for to diagnose a case of pneumonia, and then counseling the parents about how to effectively use antibiotic treatment. So I recently, in July, I was in Guatemala looking at some programs addressing this very, very simple challenge. But when you see where people live on these mountainsides in Guatemala, you realize they're not going to get to the clinic. So if a person in that village can be trained as a community health worker and can participate, what we do is we choose people from the community, often people who know a lot of the other families in the community, so they're selected by their community to go off for this training, and then we help supply them with reusable supplies, backpacks, sometimes with a flashlight or other things they might need on the job, a spoon, a cup, really simple things, a watch or this little respiration timer that counts 30 seconds so they can count the breaths, and put these people out in the field. Our supervisors go out and see them, or the government supervisors from the clinic periodically visit them to find out how they're doing and to make sure that they remember all the skills they picked up in the training. So this new idea of extending health care beyond clinic walls through community health workers is a really important initiative. So these people are trained to treat pneumonia and diarrhea and malaria in Africa. At the village level. So families don't have to walk all the way to the clinic or find a bus ride into a clinic. They actually can be treated in their own villages.
And I would think that would be very empowering of community members.
Yes, it is. I mean, for the people who've been trained, it's been a fascinating experience meeting some of these community health workers. And actually on our website at www.savethechildren.org, if you go to the Survive to Five link, you can see a community health worker in Ethiopia who actually was trained to diagnose and treat kids, and he finds a young child who's in line for vaccination who has pneumonia. So it's a really great story of how, you know, the vital role these people play in their community, how people visit them in their homes because they really have a child. They're not sure if the child is very sick, and they really want their advice. They're respected members of their communities, and they really know they're giving back. I mean, I've interviewed these community health workers in 20 countries around the world, and they really are proud of the fact that they, you know, can mean the difference between life and death for children in their villages.
I would think that's one of the greatest things that you're doing is empowering these communities and empowering the members in these communities, and that the children are then seeing that the adults in their communities are empowered, and that this could only be beneficial for everyone.
Yes. I mean, Save the Children is trying to build a sustainable solution to these healthcare problems. So for us, it's really critical that we're not directly delivering this healthcare, but we're helping to train people from that village who are going to be there for the long haul to help their community grow and develop and have children healthier and ready for school and ready to learn, really, when they get to school age because they've had better health care all through those first critical 5 years. So it's a very, empowering program. That's something that is about human capacity development. It's really not about solving these problems ourselves, but in fact finding local people who can be a resource to their community.
Networking.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes.
And sometimes we find people who are sort of at the center of a social network, like a woman who lives close to the well and everybody knows her because of that and seeks advice from her when they stop by to get water. So there's lots of different ways that communities decide who's the most connected person in the community to who could really deliver these messages most effectively.
And how did you get interested in this work, Mary Beth?
I had the opportunity. I studied at Georgetown School of Foreign Service, and after I graduated, I went overseas to Pakistan. So this was in 1984, and I was working for an aid agency that was trying to address the needs of Afghan refugees on the border. So this is sort of like at the beginning of Charlie Wilson's War, if anyone's seen that movie.
Yes, I have.
And so, Afghan families were basically setting up homes in refugee camps. So after my excellent education at Georgetown, I was spending my time taking pictures of latrines in rural Pakistan where the Afghan refugee camps were set up. And I really realized when I was there that, you know, it's important to care about people, but I thought I really needed sort of a skill package. And so I came back to the U.S. and went to University of Michigan to study public health. So public health is really about how you help a community, whereas medical education tends to be more focused on how you help a patient. So when we do public health programs, we're trying to look at, you know, what can we do to help this whole community grow healthier together?
Yes, that's a beautiful goal. And are you enjoying the work? It sounds like you still feel very passionate about what you're doing.
Yeah, I have been doing this for 20 years, and it's just, you know, it's so much more than a job. And I think working for Save the Children is sort of, you know, one of these things my own children, you know, wonder, like, because I've traveled all around the world working with Save, you know, what is mom doing this week in Afghanistan or last week in Bangladesh? And I think, you know, it really helps try and put it, or I'm trying to help my kids put it all in perspective, like just how lucky they are and how blessed they are in terms of having the ability to just to be healthy, to go outside and play safely, to have education available to them. For my daughter, you know, to be allowed to be educated, because in so many cultures that I've spent a lot of time working in, it's much harder for a little girl to go to school. So my fifth grade daughter is, you know, really fortunate to live in a country where, you know, nobody would question the value of sending a girl on to fifth grade, whereas that really does happen in a lot of countries where I work.
Yes, I know. I know that. And this is, you're listening to KZYX and Z in Philo, California. And my name is Athena Melville, your host for Education Now. And we're listening to a report from Mary Beth of Save the Children. And we'll get back to it right now. But it is also the case that there are people in our own culture that disappeared, who you know, aren't getting treatment when they need it, and it's very sad. And it's not to say that the majority here don't have hope, and all of us, of course, do have hope. But there are those that we don't talk about in our own culture, you know, who are living in poverty and who are homeless, and who are cold or too hot. And I know that people are trying and helping, trying to help them as well. But I do not want to leave this our discussion without pointing out that this is becoming a growing problem in our own culture.
Well, especially this lack of access to health care, which, you know, it was fascinating in Southern California when that group set up a free clinic outside Los Angeles, and so many people showed up for free care, free dental care, free screenings, free. So we haven't quite fixed the problem of reaching, you know, health care for all in this country, which was a goal set in 1978 that many countries, you know, signed on to. So as much as, you know, we're encouraging the growth of health care and extending these health services to people around the world, we really do have to look at poverty in the United States and people who, for one reason or another, don't have access to decent health care or education and are marginalized.
Does Save the Children work with any of the marginalized communities in the United States?
Yes, and that's actually somewhat unusual. I think a lot of international development agencies don't have a focus on poverty challenges in the United States, but Save the Children actually began in Appalachia in 1939. So we have worked in the United States since our very beginning, and we continue to work in the United States. We also work in the Central Valley in California. We work across, I think, about 17 or 18 states, providing education and health and nutrition advice to children in the United States. So trying to help kids read at grade level is a critical part of our program, our domestic program, as well as trying to combat childhood obesity. So in poor communities where maybe children or families don't always make the healthiest nutritional choices, or kids live quite far from school, so access to any kind of recreation is limited because, for example, in Appalachia, a lot of kids spend a lot of time on a school bus, actually getting to school and getting home from school. So after-school playtime that kids in the suburbs where I live in New York would have easy access to. It's not the case for kids in parts of the United States. So we're working on a number of challenges facing young people in America as well.
Yes, I'm so glad that that you said that, and to know that you are working with those challenges. I find that a lot of the food choices that this population, this marginalized population we're talking about, they don't have, but a fast food store, a little market on the corner that sells just, really not good food.
Right.
And you can maybe pick up some milk that, is fair, but that's about it. Those are your choices. And so what choices do they really have to eat healthily? And it's nice to hear that there are gardens going up in some of these communities and that there are people becoming more aware. And because to blame the obesity just on them and then being able to go outside, in a lot of our schools in this country, children don't have recess. It's a criminal what's happening to some of our kids right in the mainstream population, but in the marginalized communities, it really isn't safe to go outside.
Right, and if they don't have access to both a safe place to play as well as ideas about games that they can play and things that they can do, or just the balls and the coaches and all the other things that, frankly, better off communities have access to, the fields, et cetera. It really does harm kids' ability to grow and learn and learn social interactions that they learn from playing sports and games. So we really are trying to help foster that in the communities that we work with in the United States.
Good. That's really good news. I'm doing some research, and I'm going to be following up on some of those communities and what's being offered to them. So it's good to hear that all of you are involved in that as well. Well, I really would like you to just tell us anything else that you feel we need to know about this program, this rehydration program, or the CAPS program, or what's happening here in America, or what your future plans are.
Yeah, we actually plan to do a lot more education of Americans starting in 2010 with more communications and trying to, give Americans a little bit of a better idea of how they can help make a difference. But right now, people could find ideas on our website. There are many organizations, working hand-in-hand with us around the world to try and extend health care to communities and education. So Save the Children works on both. It's good to get them to age 5 and healthy, but then they really need to be ready for school. So we also do a lot of work in early childhood education and combining that, so nutritional messages and child stimulation messages to parents, because again, both in the United States and in more impoverished communities, as well as globally, parents have really not been taught how important interacting with their young child is and talking to their child and reading with their child or just playing simple games with the youngster is really critical to having them be ready for school. So for us, it's a pretty holistic picture. My training is in health, but we work closely with our colleagues who are working on education issues for young children so that kids are ready for school and then that the teachers are able to teach in a more open way with more dialogue, lots of teacher education to make classrooms more creative around the world, because a lot of school systems are much more didactic and rote memorization. So we're really working on that whole spectrum of, from the time women before they get pregnant to when they're pregnant and have kids and those kids are into school, trying to really support communities in their effort to sustainably address the needs of their children.
So prenatal and through birth to age 6, which I know, and most people who know anything about the development of children know, are the most critical times. The prenatal.
Yeah, early investment matters. We really look at those first months. Actually, because newborn are so fragile, so 40% of all child deaths happen in that first month of life. We really, through support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, have developed a program and are looking and doing research on what are the most important things that families and communities and clinicians can do to save newborns. But so that first month of life is critical, but then you're right, that interaction with parents, that stimulation, breastfeeding support, really critical things for communities around the world to do to have their kids be healthier and better educated.
And they're all things that we knew, you know, it's almost a priori. We knew these things, and then somehow we unlearned them living in our culture. At least that's how it seems. Because, you know, I don't think it was just like a natural thing to say, oh, I won't breastfeed. Oh, gee, I don't know what's healthy food. I really think,
yeah,
I don't think that I think it's our culture that's created this. I don't really think we're born not knowing these things.
And right. I mean, especially breastfeeding is an interesting one because, you know, it seems like the most natural option. And really, the vast majority, I'm talking more than 95% of women, can successfully breastfeed. But if our culture doesn't support that, if our culture doesn't encourage that, and this, you know, is a worldwide phenomenon, then women who have to go back to work, whether it's in the fields or in a office or in any kind of setting, that limits their ability to exclusively breastfeed for 6 months, which really ought to be the goal, that nothing but breast milk for the first 6 months of life.
You mean the child gets all your immunities through your breast milk. You just give them such a leg up. You give that child such a leg up when you breastfeed. And, you know, even if you pump your breasts and let someone else give the baby the breast milk, although the actual experience and is such a huge part of it as well.
Right, the interaction with the child. But I had, of course, with my kids, I did pump milk because I did go back to work, and I really found, you know, at first I thought this was going to be difficult, and it really wasn't that difficult. Women should give it a try because it's so much better for your baby.
It is. It is so much better for your baby, and it's also a way to actually maintain your life as an individual, occasionally to have someone give your baby your breast milk that you've pumped, and you can go to your class, or you can go out with your friend, or whatever.
You need that break, but it's a really important thing, and it's quite doable, and needless to say, it's quite affordable.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of, you know, positive research on the impact of breast milk on newborns and on children's learning abilities, and that's probably both because of the stimulation of that child looking at you know, the mother's face or any person who's giving them that interaction that happens, as well as the breast milk itself.
And yet I know when I was growing up, not for me, but there were children around me and women around me who would put the milk bottle in a little pillow that they would then put on the bed next to the baby and stick it in the baby's mouth so that then they could go do something. You know,
Now, it's a mystery. We do know a lot more about those things now. I mean, it is interesting, as you're saying, you know, some of these things that were part of our culture and then for one reason or another became to be seen as not modern, for example. But the effect of that, I mean, I just was in Bangladesh where our staff was telling me that, you know, that same thing is playing out in some countries in the developing world, especially among urban people where maybe bottle feeding is seen more modern, where, in fact, the research really suggests breast would be best for those kids. So you really are kind of trying to remind people of going back to their heritage and the fact that this naturally was such an effective way to feed children and immunize them, as you were saying, like those natural antibodies.
And bond. I mean, there's so much to that bonding as well, even though it may sound mysterious to some. But just recently I had seen where a woman was asked to leave a restaurant for not covering her breasts when she was breastfeeding her baby. You know, this idea that it's just not, you know, it's just...
Right, offensive, yeah.
Yeah, so it's strange.
Yeah.
But I also think food, I know there was an experiment done in the early 60s where if a baby was given a choice of food, you know, lots of choices around to eat, the baby not only during the day got a well-balanced meal, but was eating fruits and vegetables, you know, really good food. And so there again, I think that these children aren't choosing to eat junk food.
Right. I think it is what we make available to our children. And you're right. Some of that has to do with what is available and easy. I mean, parents are, you know, very hardworking people often. And, you know, the difficulty of getting fresh produce into their homes, et cetera, and the ease sometimes of processed foods versus, you know, raw or, you know, more whole grains, et cetera, are part of the challenges that we really face in re-educating ourselves about appropriate feeding of our kids and ourselves.
Yes, yes. Well, it's about that time we're going to have to say goodbye, but I've enjoyed this very much, Mary Beth, and I, you know, if I had ever had to learn some of these skills, I would want you to help me, because I can tell that you would be concerned that I learn something and not that I look at you as an authority figure, which is nice.
No, I mean, that's just it. I think that the nice thing and the whole thing that we've really built on is the fact that mothers seek advice from other mothers. So that's really how these community health workers in the villages, they're just a local person who's a resource. So in the same way that we coach our sisters or our friends when, you know, we're moms and they're first-time moms, that same skill set is, you know, and that same behavior, it happens worldwide. It's the most global phenomenon I've ever seen. It's sort of women-to-women advice giving, et cetera. So it's great to know that that's, you know, giving, you know, moms a hand up in this country, and it's helping moms around the world as well.
Yes, it's beautiful. And we had someone on from Save the Children a few months back who really gave us a good deal of information on what's happening in terms of education and helping communities learn how to educate their own little people from 0 through 6. And that was wonderful, too. And so I thank you, and I thank Save the Children for all the wonderful work that you do. And I love the website. Can you give the address again to the website?
Sure. It's just www.savethechildren.org. And there's lots of information there about our programs in health, education, and in emergency response.
Yes, it's just wonderful. It's wonderful what all of you are doing. And I also want to thank Rebecca O'Halloran for helping me get in touch with you, because I just really want to get the message out, and I love what you're doing. And thank you again so very, very much, Mary Beth.
Thank you so much.
Well, there you have our Survive to Five campaign chief, Mary Beth from Save the Children. And I'll give you that website one more time. It's www.savethechildren.org. And I enjoyed that, and I hope that you did too. And now we're going to, I want to tell you that this is KZYX 90.7 FM in Philo, and KZYZ FM in Willetson, Ukiah, and K201 HR FM in Fort Bragg, and also streaming on the web at kzyx.org. I'm Athena Melville, and this is Education Now, and I'm going to give you some updates, and I'll even open the lines if you want to call in. But first, we're going to have a little music. So here we go with some music.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows, and what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions, and rainbows have nothing to hide. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. I know they're wrong, wait and see. Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me. Who said that every wish would would be heard and answered when wished on the morning star. Somebody thought of that, and someone believed it. Look what it's done so far. What's so amazing that keeps us stargazing? And what do we think we might see? Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me.
And well, I think that we have found the rainbow connection, and that is KZYX and Z, this wonderful radio station. And happy birthday, KZYX and Z. Today marks 20 years serving Mendocino County and beyond. It also marks National Information Literacy Awareness Month, 2009. And I want to share a proclamation from President Barack Obama with you. And keep in mind that we always do a little, we do shows on the media and education here frequently. And this is the proclamation from Barack Obama. National Information Literacy Awareness Month 2009 starts this October 1st by the President of the United States of America. Every day we are inundated with vast amounts of information. A 24-hour news cycle and thousands of global television and radio networks, coupled with an immense array of online resources, have challenged our long-held perceptions of information management. Rather than merely processing data, we must also learn the skills necessary to acquire, collate, and evaluate information for any situation. This new type of literacy also requires competency with communication technologies, including computers and mobile devices that can help in our day-to-day decision-making. National Information Literacy Awareness Month highlights the need for all Americans to be adept in the skills necessary to effectively navigate the information age. Though we may know how to find the information we need, we must also know how to evaluate it. Over the past decade, we have seen a crisis of authenticity emerge. We now live in a world where anyone can publish an opinion or perspective, whether true or not, and have the opinion amplified within the information marketplace. At the same time, Americans have unprecedented access to the diverse and independent sources of information, as well as institutions such as libraries and universities that can help separate truth from fiction and signal from noise. Our nation's educators and institutions of learning must be aware of and adjust to these new realities. In addition to the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, it is equally important that our students are given the tools required to take advantage of the information available to them. The ability to seek, find, and decipher information can be applied to countless life decisions, whether financial, medical, educational, or chemical. This month, we dedicate ourselves to increasing information literacy awareness so that all citizens understand its vital importance. An informed and educated citizenry is essential to the functioning of our modern democratic society. And I encourage educational and community institutions across the country to help Americans find and evaluate the information they seek in all its forms. Now, therefore, I, Barack Obama, President of the United States of America, by virtue of authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim October 2009 as National Information Literacy Awareness Month. I call upon the people of the United States to recognize the important role information plays in our daily lives and appreciate the need for a greater understanding of its impact. Signed, Barack Obama. I hope President Obama's proclamation helps you understand just how important our shared treasure, KZYX and Z, and KZYX.org are, and that you will get your pledge renewals in as soon as possible so that our live drive can be a fun-filled and informative celebration. Because for news, national and international and local, for music of every venue, for diversity of opinion and perspective, KZYX and Z is here for you, because you and all of us give. So do it now. Return your renewal or go online at kzyx.org and become a member. Join us if you are not now a member, and together we can create the future. Well, I hope that all of you will participate. And here's a little humor for you on that very topic.
There is nothing wrong. Do not attempt to adjust it. We are controlling transmission. Sit quietly and we will control all that you hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong. You are about to participate in a great adventure.
I think I'll write a check to KZYX and Z. Why would I do that? They're a voice for the community. They have it all. Music, public affairs, news, entertainment. Get out of my head. Who are you? Just trying to convince you to do the right thing. Why don't the owners take care of their money problems? We are the owners. It's listener-supported community radio. I can't write a check. I don't have any checks. Go to their website, kzyx.org. All right. Get out of my head.
Resistance is futile.
Thank you for that, Rich. And if you would like to help out here during the pledge drive, the live drive, you can call the station during working hours at 895-2324 and volunteer to answer phones. And I thank you so much. So please, I love the silent pledge drive myself, because it that way, you know, I would like it if it was all just silently came in and we just had a party for a week. That's my dream for KZYX and Z. Well, now the lines are open if you want to talk to me. Or ask any questions, 895-2448, or if you're out of the area, 1-800-499-7117. And I have several things to share with you. I don't know if I'll get to all of them, but one is from Project Censored. Now, you can get the top 25 censored stories for 2009 at projectcensored.org. That's Project Censored, SORED.ORG. One of you asked me to please give web addresses more slowly. ProjectCensored.ORG. And this is one of the top 25 censored stories. Bush profiteers collect billions from No Child Left Behind. The architect of No Child Left Behind, President Bush's first senior education advisor, Sandy Kress, has turned the program, which has consistently proven disastrous in the realm of education, into a huge success in the realm of corporate profiteering. After ushering No Child Left Behind through the U.S. House of Representatives in 2001 with no public hearings, Kress went from lawmaker turning on the spigot for special federal funds to lobbyists, tapping into those billions of dollars of federal money for private investors well connected to the Bush administration. And some of those who reaped such rewards, because I don't want, pardon me, to read you the entire report, of course, were those people who prepared the test. Three McGraw-Hill, Houghton Mifflin, and Harcourt General, and who have since the passage of No Child Left Behind come to dominate the testing market, identified by Wall Street analysts in the wake of the 2000 election as Bush stocks. All three owners, like Harold McGraw III, who has longstanding ties to the Bush administration, and the lobbying efforts of Sandy Kress have pulled in billions of dollars that are not reaching children, are reaching lobbyists and test manufacturers. Please, please go read this. And then from the New York Times, there's a wonderful article by Paul Krugman, The Uneducated American, which I strongly encourage you to read. Once again, it's from the New York Times, posted online on October 9th, 2009. And he said, if you had to explain America's economic success with one word, that word would be education. In the 19th century, America led the way in universal basic education. Then, as other nations followed suit, the high school revolution of the early 20th century took us to a whole new level. And if the years after World War II, America established a commanding position in higher education. But that was then. The rise of American education was overwhelmingly the rise of public education. And for the past 30 years, our political scene has been dominated by the view that any and all government spending is a waste of taxpayer dollars. Education is one of the largest components of public spending, has inevitably suffered. Please try to go read this wonderful article by Krugman. It's just so informative. He says, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the United States economy lost 273,000 jobs last month. Of those lost jobs, 29,000 were in state and local education. Bring the total losses in that category over the past 5 months to 143,000. That may not sound like much, but education is one of those areas that should and normally does keep growing even during a recession. Markets may be troubled, but there's no reason to stop teaching our children. Yet that's exactly what we're doing. There's no mystery about what's going on. Education is mainly the responsibility of state and local governments, which are in dire physical straits. Adequate federal aid could have made a big difference, but while some aid has been provided, it has made up only a fraction of the shortfall. In part, that's because back in February, centrist senators insisted on stripping much of that aid from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, also known as the stimulus bill. So that's Paul Krugman. You'll want to take a look at that from the New York Times. And then from the Chronicle of Higher Education, a great article by Diane Auer Jones. In the ongoing conversation about institutional quality, I continuously see references to retention and graduation rates as the, or at least a key indicator of institutional quality. But what if we have it all wrong? What if measuring graduation and retention rates as evidence of institutional quality is like taking a person's temperature to evaluate the efficacy or effectiveness of his blood pressure medication? While it may be true that at the margin some institutions are more successful at retaining and graduating disadvantaged students than others, and we should certainly study those institutions to find out what they do right, in general, retention and graduation rates correlate more closely to student socioeconomic status and family situation than they do to institutional type, sector, or quality. So check that out from the Chronicles of Higher Education, August 21st, 2009. A great article. Now, I want to tell you that I still have a few complimentary copies of Montessori Life. If you want one, email me at hermes@pacific.net. That's hermes@pacific.net. I always enjoy your comments and suggestions. And there are about 7 copies that went out, and I have some more, so if you want one. And this month, on October 29th, there'll be a special edition of Education Now, October 29th at 7 p.m., a live interview and discussion with executive producer Robert Compton regarding his documentaries 2 Million Minutes and 2 Million Minutes, The 21st Century Solution. I hope you will tune in and call in. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation at the studios of KZYX&Z in Philo, California. And I just have to thank our operations director, Rich Culbertson, because he's just taught me so much and he's such a support, and all the staff here at KZYX&Z. All programs, Education Now is featured in the monthly American Montessori e-newsletter and listed on their events calendar at www.amshq.org. That's www.amshq.org. All programs aired on Education Now can be heard with a download at our website, www.pacificsites.com/Hermes. Or you could Google Melville Montessori School and it will come up for you. Tomorrow here at KZYX&Z, at 9 o'clock, we have The Truth About Money. John Sakowitz talks with David Porter, who has been involved in real estate and mortgage lending for more than 30 years and now specializes in building, marketing, and financing best practices and sustainability. They'll talk about green lending and mortgages and financing green building and design projects. And then tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock on Corporations and Democracy, you'll want to connect with Annie Esposito and Steve Scalmanini. They have a wonderful show prepared for you. So tune in to Corporations and Democracy Friday at 1. You'll want to be sure to do that. And of course, there's always wonderful music on Fridays in the morning. We have wonderful classical with Gordon Black. And then in the afternoon, we have wonderful, just funky music with Hoodoo Dance Party and Shari Williams Andrews. We have it all here. It's wonderful. And we hope that you'll join us and become a member. Now, tonight, you'll want to stay tuned for The Treehouse with W. Dan, that righteous man who will make you laugh after Earth and Sky, which will be followed by Dead Air. I thank you very much for tuning in. And once again, I always appreciate your comments. You can contact me at hermes@pacific.net. I receive your emails and I take all of your comments to heart, and I enjoy it very much. So we'll see you. I'll be here to engineer for Joy LeClaire's Forthright Radio next Wednesday during the pledge drive. She has some wonderful treats in store for you. Let's see. She's going to have Robert Fisk and Henry Pollack. So it's going to be a great show. So tune in on Wednesday, next Wednesday, for Forthright Radio at 9 in the morning. Thank you, one and all, for listening. And here we go. I'm going to give you Earth and Sky in just a minute. Dan is waiting out there in the wings. I can see his happy face. He's climbing up into the treehouse now. So you do be ready.
Earth and Sky.